to the Track and Food Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Ma. Thank you for joining us once again. Mick, how are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm good as well.
Oh, good.
How are you?
I'm good. That is my co-host, Mickey McLeod. You are listening to, what is this now? What are we at? Episode 15, 14?
15.
This is episode 15?
Wow. Oh. I didn't get you anything, man. Sorry.
I think we can do that when we do episode 20. I think that's something that we should do.
15, that's like a pin, isn't it? We could do a pin.
We could do a pin.
Yeah, let's get some pins going.
This has been a really fun ride for both of us. We have been talking about and having guests on talking about food and culture. And today we're actually going to do something different. On the previous, I think, two episodes, we've brought up this new idea, which came to me a little while ago, having listened to something else one day. And so today we're going to be doing a special episode where we're going to be talking about a book that we both finished reading. Mick, did you do your homework?
I finished it.
Yes, he did his homework. if anybody who listened to the last episode or the one previous, the book we chose was Anthony Bourdain's seminal book, Kitchen Confidential, which came out in the year 2000. It is the book that put him on the map in the forefront of people's minds as a food, TV, and personality and all that stuff. We both read it. We both didn't. How much did you know about Anthony Bourdain going into this, by the way?
I knew next to nothing.
Okay, so we're both about the same way on this one.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I know he was a super influential TV personality and celebrity chef, but I really knew next to nothing about about this guy.
Okay, so you and I are very much in the same way. And I'm actually very excited about that. That's, I think, one of the reasons why I picked this book.
Hopefully people listening aren't scoffing like, oh, you guys do a food and culture podcast, but you do nothing about Anthony Bourdain.
Okay. So there's probably some assholes out there who are probably thinking, well, you two are obviously don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, we're trying. Okay.
Yes.
People, we're trying.
But I mean, I think part of it is also understanding that we are not going to know everything. There's so much about food and culture in this world that we're not, I don't think everyone's going to come up to me and be like, do you know everything about Paula Deen? I know nothing about Paula Deen really.
No.
You know,
I know she likes butter.
Yeah, there you go. And she's a, she likes, what is it? She does Southern food. I think that's what her thing is.
Yeah, it's all butter. Like, okay. And deep fried.
I know a good amount about Gordon Ramsay, and I'm a big fan of Danny Meyer. I know some stuff about people here in Canada, but yeah, I'm sorry. If you're mad that we don't know much about Anthony Bourdain at this point right now, well, sorry.
Well, we do now.
Yeah, we do now. We know a little bit.
I think we should mention, though, that it's actually the Insider's Edition that we read, which is really dope because not only is it the original book, but it also has his revisions written in, and also has his
afterward,
which he, you know, reflects on and talks about it. And this is, I think, in 2006 when he was kind of right in the middle of doing his Parts Unknown series on, was it on CNN?
Yeah. So Parts Unknown is on CNN. And then I think his first one, which was, what was the first one? First show was on?
I don't know.
No, it's the one that was on Fox.
Oh yeah. Well, he was on Top Chef.
Yeah.
Originally, that was his first sort of celebrity gig.
Okay.
And then he was on a couple other ones. I don't watch TV, man.
Yeah, see, now we're failing. Okay, anyway, you guys can send us messages and get us fixed up on that one. But we did do research for this book. We both read the book. I did a little bit of research on his career. I don't know. That first TV show that he did is going to come back to me in about 10 minutes, and then I'm going to feel like an idiot. Anyways. We both read the book. It is actually a very, very entertaining read.
Super entertaining.
Okay. Reading. So my first, one of the first things that came to mind as I was reading this.
Was it a cook's tour? A cook's tour?
No, I don't think that's it.
The layover taste?
Are you researching right now?
Researching right now.
Okay.
I'll just cut it out.
My first thing that really came out of this one, it was like, I understand why he was so popular, especially with chefs. This is definitely a chef's book. He details the life of a chef, how people get into the industry, how he got into the industry back in the early to mid 70s, why he stayed in the industry all these years. He details the triumphs and struggles of a working chef, which anybody out there who's worked as a chef or worked in kitchens or worked in the restaurant industry, as you and I both have, I've seen this through and throughout with my friends, people who still work in the industry. It is a very, very hard life. It's grueling hours. It's very low pay. There's not a lot of reward. If you love it, you love it. And he talks about it in a lot of ways. Like the chefs that stay in it for a long time, I think he calls them mercenaries.
Yeah.
The guys that take a lot of pride. I actually want to talk about that because I actually feel like I'm a mercenary when it comes to working the bar scene.
Mercenary.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's funny you mentioned that because there's a lot of similarities between.
He still talks about the army.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but also front house and, you know, bartending. He doesn't, it's based essentially on the back of house, but there are parts that bleed into just the restaurant
community, yeah.
community as well.
Absolutely.
And also the front house staff. And he talks very glowingly about runners and porters as well.
Yeah. And so to the couple of things that I learned about when I was researching a little bit about this book and why he wrote it, how it became, made him really popular. It came about back in 1999 when he was working at Le Hal, which was the restaurant he eventually took over. I think he took it over in 1998. It was a restaurant in downtown. I think it was on Park Avenue in New York City. Le Hal was actually named after the Paris Central Food Market, which was demolished in 1971. I think they've actually just rebuilt it and they're actually doing a lot of renovations. I think they actually just finished them this year. And Le Hal, there was restaurants in Tokyo. I think there was one in Miami, which all shut down. I think the Le Hal, I think the last one.
They went bankrupt, right?
They went bankrupt in 2007, I think. And there's a couple, I think the last restaurant in the group, I think shut down in 2016.
2016, yeah. 2016, that's what
I think that's what it was. But he wrote an essay that was published in the New Yorker called Don't Eat Before Reading This. And it really touches on his idea of like, I think what really made him popular was like how kind of the idea of the whole essay was don't eat fish on Mondays was kind of the thing that kind of people glommed onto the idea.
Yeah.
It's like chefs order their fish on Fridays. They try to sell it on Friday, Saturdays. And then whatever's not sold by Sunday, Monday is like the garbage fish you're going to get on Mondays. And it was kind of a beaming point for people. And I guess supposedly after 10 years after, like for the next 10 years, like if you were a restaurant in New York City or anywhere prominent, selling fish on Mondays and Tuesdays was like, or like Sunday, Mondays was like kind of a pain in the ass. Like it just, people would not do it.
Yeah.
So he was very influential in that sense. And that's probably one of the main reasons why he was able to get the book. And it was funny when you're reading this, the reason why he published this is because he knew his wife knew Anthony Bourdain's grandmother or his mother.
Oh, okay.
And they kind of got introduced and that's how he got a story. And he just submitted it like randomly as like a chef and kind of like this was something on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of like what built upon, like he got a lot of good popularity and press from this, and that's where he kind of built on, and that's how this book came about.
Yeah. I think we should take people through just sort of like the book and how it follows, or not how it follows.
Oh, no,
like,
I have some quotes from this book that I definitely want to talk about.
And also it should be stated that if you don't know Anthony Bourdain he was actually quite a prolific writer as well. He wrote a lot of fiction. He wrote, so he was quite a prominent writer.
Yeah, he did all that stuff in the 90s. Yeah, he did that stuff in the 90s. Right?
Yeah, and all throughout the early 2002 before he started becoming more of a TV celebrity. That was his main thing on the side as being a chef. He would write about his experience, stuff like that. But not only his experiences, he was really into like the comic book world. So he ended up doing a graphic novel called Get Jiro, which is kind of like a sort of a play on Kill Bill a little bit. It's like this like crazy Japanese chef that came to fruition, I think, in 2015.
Well, Bradley Cooper almost played him in a TV series, actually.
It
was going to be based off this book.
Yeah.
It was a series that was going to be on, I think it was Fox or something like this. And it was like in 2005. And Bradley Cooper like did like a first few pilot episodes of this. And it just never came to fruition. But
a little side
note.
You can actually
watch those, I think, supposedly on YouTube or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. So. Side note on Thanksgiving. We just had Thanksgiving a couple of days ago here in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. And my mom would not stop talking about A Star Is Born with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. Yeah, she would not stop talking about it.
Like, did she like it?
She loved it. She loved it. Apparently, it's really good.
Lady Gaga gets
all stripped down and like she's playing like her actual hair color and like she just plays her own role.
The biggest thing is I heard is that Bradley Cooper was, I suppose he like produced it and got this movie off the ground.
Yeah.
And I think he wrote it too. The other thing is, I suppose it was like a big thing for him to her not to wear makeup during the whole filming of this.
Yeah.
So, but
I don't know.
I've heard.
I'm going to probably wait like 2-3 years to see it as they usually do with new releases.
Well, this movie reminds me of the kind of the praise that was centered around when Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon did Walk the Line back in 2005.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was kind of a, it seems like kind of a biopic, kind of, I don't know if it's like a love story between the two of them. But I don't know.
Yeah.
But he supposedly is a front runner right now for the Oscar.
Good. Yeah. Good stuff.
I like Bradley Cooper. I think he's really good.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I used to watch Inside the Actor's Studio.
Oh, yeah. I love that
show.
You ever seen the Johnny Depp one? It's really good.
I've seen all of them, but there's a really funny one with Al Pacino.
The Simpsons
one's
really good
too. Where Bradley
Cooper
is actually asking a question to Al Pacino.
Really?
Yeah. It's really funny. And he's like a young student in
a student asking Al Pacino?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because Inside the Actor's Studio is from, it's a school.
Yeah, it's a school.
Acting school. With that really funny dude, I can't remember what his name is at the moment, but
he's old as fuck too.
Yeah, he's super old. Yeah. So, anyways, back to the book. So, if you haven't heard of it or read it, Kitchen Confidential follows, like Jamie said, Anthony Bourdain's initial romanticism with culinary world and his start in the culinary world, his schooling, and then basically every place he's worked at, naming names, naming situations, up until his time at the restaurant. So that's basically the book, and it really is an expose and a tell-all of restaurant life, and especially chef life and chef culture. That fish thing, so interesting, and like the whole specials thing is so. But it's funny when you work in the industry. Like
I don't know who does specials. I don't know anyone who does specials, but he makes it seem
I know
like
never to order what the feature of the special.
I never order the special because I know it's
all
the garbage.
It is the leftover food that they're trying to fucking sell.
Yeah. So it's like when he's like, we have to have a fish special, a pasta special, all this stuff, or like a special of the night. I'm like, I don't know any restaurants that do really special. Like there is restaurants in the city that do specials, but it's like kind of, I don't think anyone first off calls it specials anymore.
Well, like, so you want to,
that, that
get
part
the
is
feature,
one of the things that dates
the feature you want to get on like the first few days, never get the special. The feature is good.
Yeah. The feature,
if they're featuring something or showcasing some sort of new cut of meat or a new product, but the special, stay away from the special.
Exactly.
But it's funny. You work in the industry, you know, these things, but then somebody writes a book like this and to the general public,
they have no idea.
These things are mysteries. So, I mean, in that vein, it was a really like, I connected really, really quickly with this book. For sure.
Well, I mean, especially for you and I, like there is parts of this book where I was like, oh yeah, I've been in that situation. Oh, I've seen that situation. Oh, I've like, you understand it from coming from our perspective.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole 2 pages where he talks about bartenders, and I was just like,
yeah.
Oh, I know exactly everything he's saying here.
It's kind of like,
and
a
there's a couple things I don't
want to
bring
up.
I don't want to talk about on the air because I just feel like it's just a little bit touch and go.
Yeah.
Especially, but there's same things he says about servers, but like he talks about the, I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself right now because I kind of want to go in order a little bit of, because I have a lot of things I'm going to bring up with you with quotes and pages and passages I want to talk about.
Right.
But there is one part where he talks about the people in the kitchen, and he talks about, especially in New York City, we're having a lot of the immigrants working there and people from Mexico and all these other countries. And they're the ones that are actually making all the food. And it's like, not, you know, the people from, you know, it's, I think this is a well-known thing in the industry, is that like a lot of people of color or people of other countries who come to the United States and Canada, specifically as we talk about our countries where we live, that they're the ones cooking our food. I mean, and I've been in that situation 100%. I worked in Toronto. I worked at this place called Bar Italia. Every single person in the kitchen was from Sri Lanka. They all spoke English. They were all awesome, but they were fucking great workers. They were the best workers I've ever seen in my life. They were loyal. They never complained. They did their jobs really well. They made food awesome. And I loved working with every single one of them. And they were fantastic. So when he was talking about this with these guys, then he's like, I'd rather have, you know, that guy that I can, like a lead who I know can cook my food day in, day out, the same way, the way I want it, versus the fucking snot-nosed punk who just came from the culinary school and who thinks he's the next, you know, Mario Batali or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I'd rather have that guy. When I read that, I was like, 100%, I 100% understand that. And that is where I think a lot of people resonated with this book. And I think he writes this book like a rock star, for one. He's very poignant. He's very descriptive. He gives you a lot of, he doesn't sugarcoat some things.
No, not at all. Yeah.
And I think people love that about him because he's, I think one of the, maybe at this point when this was written, that was probably what was missing in the industry, is people were fake. Maybe they came across as fake, or they were afraid to talk about how things were actually.
Yeah. Happening. Yeah. Well, he got a lot of flack from a lot of industry veterans about
I can see
the
why.
Brashness and the transparency of the book.
Cause he outed them.
Yeah. I was reading this book, and I'll be honest with you, I actually read this in 2 sittings. That's how much of a page turner this is. If you are in the restaurant industry,
you read it in 2 sittings?
2 sittings.
Holy shit.
Yeah, 2 sittings. I just couldn't put it down.
I don't think I've ever read a book like that before.
Yeah, so 5 hours and 4.5 hours or whatever it was. Yeah.
I'm usually like a 2 hour guy, and then I'll stop and then.
No, I plowed through it for sure.
That's awesome. Because you fucking had to.
And also because I was really into it. It was good first book for our little Track and Food Book Club here on the podcast.
Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, Track and Food Book Club.
Okay,
Track Episode and Food 1.
Book. Episode 1, there we go. I didn't know if we had a name for it.
We'll workshop it. But I was trying to, since Jamie and I aren't super familiar with him and his celebrity, I was trying to think how he got so popular, how he became like this, you know, like the working man's sort of chef celebrity. Like, he has such a huge cult following, and you know, and I was trying to like decode and dissect why this is. And like, to me on the outside looking in, he's just another celebrity chef, right? Who wrote books, you know, who's a great storyteller, who embellished obviously a fair bit in the book, I would imagine.
Oh, probably.
And I was trying to think to myself why he was so popular, because I don't have an insight into the world of like celebrity chefs. I have nothing but contempt for reality television. I do not watch TV. So I was trying to like figure out how he became so popular. And obviously through books like this and just his brutal honesty and his like complete reluctancy to sugarcoat anything, I think was a huge, huge part of
it. Well, I think he's relatable. That's why.
And he's relatable. He's like the common man's. Yeah. They
could, you could, how many guys can we say that we've met are the type of guy where you could see them after a shift with their apron on, a cigarette in their mouth, a beer in their hand. They've got, you know, stubble. They've got slick, greasy hair. They've got tattoos everywhere. They love to go see a show. How many of those chefs do we know?
Do we know?
Yeah.
A billion.
A million of them. You know what I mean? And that's exactly what he is.
Yeah.
So he's 100% relatable. If I'm a chef or if I work in the industry and I'm reading this book, I'm like, holy fuck, this guy's me.
Yeah.
This guy is me when he's writing this. I remember this. I remember being that guy. I can relate to this guy 100%.
Yeah.
I've had nights where I've gone out and done cocaine all night long. Like that's what someone's probably thinking.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff like that, you know, and like, I'm not advocating that, by the way. But you know what I mean? Like he talked the talk
and he walked the walk. Yeah. And we had Jeff Koop on a couple episodes ago, and he was saying, we were talking about how it's easier to follow someone in a leading role if you respect them. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think a lot of people, you know, through his career just had nothing but admiration and respect for him, because not only did he tell it like it is, but he lived that life. Right.
Well, and he talks about it. Like he was like, even in the mid-90s, he was like broke as shit.
Yeah.
He's like living on couches. He has no money. He's from job to job to job. Like, do you remember that one part where he talks about going to the interview at that one place, that steakhouse?
Yeah.
And he's sitting there and he's like, he's waiting at the bar and he sees all these other guys who are waiting and he's thinking, should I have a beer or should I not have a beer? And then he just goes and he leaves and he's sweating and he's uncomfortable. And like, how many times have you been in that situation?
Yeah.
I've been in that situation so many times.
In interview process, yeah.
And you're just waiting to get a job. And you're broke and you need money and you're like,
yeah.
That is so relatable to so many people. And I think that is something that, I don't know if it inspires people, because I don't know if I would take away a lot of things from this book and be like, I want to be this guy. But he does write it in a romantic way that it makes you seem like working as a chef can be fun. But he's, especially in the beginning, it comes across that way. But I think as the years progress, you can see him just, it's a job.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, there is a certain element of this sort of back of house kitchen sort of bro culture, which I know that he in later years sort of felt.
He kind of regretted.
Writing.
Yeah. He talked about that.
I think it works like in that time frame. Right. So this is like, you know, it's late 70s and 80s in New York. Right. Obviously that shit's going on, but you know, reading it now with the context of the world we live in now, it did seem a bit sensationalized and a bit too, like, I wouldn't recommend, like, if I was like a parent and read this book, I wouldn't recommend my kid getting into the restaurant industry.
No.
Right? Not at all.
Why would you do that?
No, of course not. And obviously the landscape has drastically changed since this was written. But you know, we're all humans. We love stories, right? We love good stories. And this to me is kind of as real as it kind of gets, because we know, because we've lived through all this shit. And I'm assuming a lot of people listening to this podcast have lived through every scenario written in this book, whether it be embellished or not, have lived through aspects of this book. So,
well, I mean, I'm just like, there's a couple things that I wanted to talk about, and I'm just going to quote one over here. But like in one chapter, he talks about owner syndromes and other medical anomalies. He, like the first paragraph, he talks about, to want to own a restaurant can be a strange and terrible affliction. What causes such a destructive urge in so many otherwise sensible people? Why would anyone who has worked hard, saved money, and often been successful in other fields want to pump his hard-earned cash down a hole that statistically, at least, will almost utterly prove dry?
Yeah.
Like that right there is just like, how many, like I've thought about opening a restaurant a million times over and I've seen so many people who do it, and it's just like.
And also a common theme on this podcast as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's,
you
like,
know, we've had Ron Oliver on, you know, we just had Sean Layton, who's about to get into this wonderful, wacky world of restaurant ownership.
And we wish him all the best. And I believe they're going to do very well.
Yeah.
But it's, man, it is a fucking slog and it's scary. And he sees that even in his time. And when I read that, I immediately highlighted it, because I was just like, this is he. And I understand why it makes sense. I was just like, this man talks the talk and he he's not afraid to tell people how it is exactly. And I think that's what I related most to it.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been in so many of these situations. I mean, the first thing that I even told you, I think when I first started reading the book and you hadn't started it yet, I remember I told you, I said, just wait till you get to page 25 and 26.
Nah, man.
No,
but that's that whole bro stuff.
No,
I'm
the bro code, but
about.
It's no, but no, but what I mean is like, I understand why it's at the beginning, but you see, it's, if you are reading this book and you're 19 years old and you just got into the kitchen world and you read this book, you would like walk away from me like, it's exactly, when I read that, I was like, oh my God, I can see a 21 year old guy or girl, not even a chef, you can be in the industry
yeah.
reading that and being like, I want to be this guy and I want to have an experience like this.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's true. It's
I can read it, but I can, or I can just, you want me to read it or do you want me to summarize it?
No, well, basically he talks about his first experience online and basically there's a wedding and he ends up walking into two people having sex in a walk-in cooler, which I can't say that I personally have experienced.
No, but you're leaving out the major point. What is the major point here?
What, that she was on her wedding day?
It was her wedding day. Yeah. And
but I see
the
me
chef was
fundamentally
the
as
groom
a man,
was at the wedding in the other room yeah. and she went in the back and she slept with one of the, she had sex with right. one of the chefs right there.
Yeah.
On her fucking
but
wedding
I feel
day.
Like that story is one of these points of sensationalism because A, I don't agree with that personally as a human being.
And he even writes, and I knew then, dear reader, for the first time, I wanted to be a chef.
Yeah. See, I found that to be sort of contrived. And
oh no, 100%. I bet you there's probably so many falsehoods there.
But so when you sent me that, you're like, oh yeah, I see what people are. I was like, oh, no, but I scoff and eye rolled.
No, but it's why people glamorize the rock and roll industry. It's why people want to be Keith Richards. It's why people want to be rock stars. It's like, that is right there.
Yeah.
That is exactly why you read that. You want to be, you, people want to live that, you know, that naughty lifestyle. And it's like,
naughty lifestyle.
Just
that's
naughty.
A good coding. Yeah, that's good. That's a good way to put it. But I mean, that there's countless examples of that rock star sort of like take no prisoners, mercenary. I think he refers to themselves as mercenaries and Ecuadorian mercenaries. So that's the storytelling part, which I had to like take a step back and be like, okay, I'm reading a book. Like,
well, yeah, it has
it's
to,
not my personal
and it has
beliefs
to be, it has
on
to be entertaining.
Society and the
At
world.
The other day,
it has to be entertaining, absolutely. And I think in that vein, the book works like insanely well.
Yeah.
Insanely well.
I think that's right there why it's so popular.
Yeah.
It's fucking entertaining. But here's a better question for you. In 2018, this book was written 18 years ago. It's 2018.
Yeah.
In the world that we live in now, in the Me Too movement, do you think he could have written this book now and it would have had the same reaction?
Well, just the
bro culture.
Well, it was more like an expose. I don't. Really,
but I mean, the way he sensationalizes the
bro. He doesn't
bro
really implicate himself.
No. I'm not saying him. I'm not saying what he did. I'm not saying he's doing anything wrong. I'm just saying the way he sensationalizes the bro culture.
Yeah, that's one of my that was one of my concerns reading this book is that, you know, people get a hold of this kind of stuff and can't really separate the fact that it's entertainment, right? And so, like you just said, like someone reading this book wants to get into it and I want to be a badass mercenary chef and, you know, fuck women on their wedding nights and, you know, do heroin and, you know, don't sleep.
And then go for beers with the boys afterwards and do
exactly,
all that stuff.
Yeah. Which is, you know, you had an interesting comment. We were talking about this with Jeff. You said kind of a coming of age story, right? And that's what this is. It's his journey through his
lens.
Through his lens and also his experiences, right? So this doesn't hold true for everybody, but there is that sort of, like you said, naughty side of sensationalism that people gravitate towards too.
Oh, absolutely.
But I chalk that up to storytelling. Like everyone loves a good story, whether it's a story about, you know, debauchery in the kitchen and food industry, or whether it's a story about, you know.
Well, I mean, you could
anything else.
You
really.
Could, but the interesting thing about this, and it's like you see it in movies like The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
You can probably apply these to a lot, and especially a lot of the bro culture, careers out there.
Yeah.
You know, like that's pretty much exactly. And why do people love The Wolf of Wall Street? You know, the guy was a dick. He treated women like garbage. He was horrible to his wife. He was a horrible father. He scammed people out of money.
Yeah.
Yet people look at that and look at Jordan Belfort and they look at all the things
that
in that movie.
That's cool. Yeah. That's
exactly.
cool, man. I wanted to be that guy. It's all kind of bullshit.
It's total bullshit.
But it is indicative of that time.
Yeah.
Right? That time. I'm really, really glad that I live in the current times because there is like you said, the Me Too movement, all that kind of stuff, and equality, not only for gender equality, but also racial equality.
After what we just saw last week with stuff going down in the States. I mean,
So it's a fun window into that world. Would he be able to get away with it now? Maybe not. But I think the afterword and him kind of coming back and again, it just harkens to his story. Like he felt remorse about certain stuff he wrote in here,
yeah,
and certain people he outed. And you can have that full spectrum of analyzing something you've done and, you know, realizing that you've made a mistake and, you know, correct it by apologizing. And just, it's a total full circle experience. And like I said before, this is the insider's edition. If you're going to read this book, read the insider's edition with the afterword, because it just totally puts everything in perspective. But I can see when it came out, it was like, you know, a kick to the nuts to certain people and certain industry types.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Some stuff like that.
So we should get into favorite parts of the book, I think. Cause I think we're going to have a lot, but I'm interested to hear yours in contrast with mine.
I'm not going to say there's favorite. I mean, there's a lot of favorite parts that I love about the book. There's just certain things
that resonated with you.
Certain things that resonate with me. On page 62, I highlighted this one area when he talks about working with chefs in the city. And I think I touched on this a little bit earlier. He talks about no one understands and appreciates the American dream of hard work leading to material rewards better than a non-American. The Ecuadorian, Mexican, Dominican, and Salvadorian cooks I've worked with over the years make most CIA, which I think he means is the Culinary Institute of America, educated white boys look like clumsy, sniveling little punks. And when I read that, I was like, that's what I touched on earlier. I 100%. I mean, he's definitely glossing over, unfortunately, a lot of people. I think he's generalizing, but I think
selling the book part,
exactly. But he even touches on it as he goes further along in the page. He says, your customers arrive expecting the same dish prepared the same way they had it before. They don't want some budding Wolfgang Puck having fun with kiwis and coriander with a menu's item I've come to love. Which, working in the industry, I've been around people like that. I mean, even in the bar industry, you know, you get, and I'm not going to, what I'm about to say here, I'm not going to knock anybody who is very creative, or, you know, we've met bartenders who are very creative and they want to create the new drink and they're very aspiratorial.
Right.
But sometimes they forget, like, you know, and I've been around people like this. It's like, you know, there's more to just doing that. You have to be a good worker too. So I think what he's really just getting at is like, I'd rather work with someone who's a really good worker
right.
than someone who's just, I'm a stud and look at me and I can do everything. But no, he's like, I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to get at here, but
yeah, there's certain levels you can get to in the cocktail world and the culinary world.
Yeah, I mean, that can be with anything.
Yeah, there's certain gradients and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But at a certain point, you kind of want what you want. But then, you know, you have to admire the creativity and the, you know, people like, I can't even think of a crazy, like, 4-star Michelin chef and like the kind of food that they prepare.
It's kind of funny because, like, and I can't believe I'm going to quote this movie, but The Devil Wears Prada.
Which, oh my God.
No, it's weird. I'll
allow it.
I've actually never really fully seen this movie, but I remember kind of flipping through the channels one day and I caught a bit of it because Meryl Streep's in it and I like her, but there was a point in the movie where she talks about this, I think it's Anne Hathaway was the main actress in the movie, but she looks at her and she's wearing this one belt, I think it is, or something. And she says, where do you think those ideas come from? They come from high fashion. We're the ones who create the ideas and eventually they trickle down to, you know, the Gaps and the Banana Republics and all that stuff. It's like, the, you know, whatever's high fashion now will be trickling down to the main society in a couple of years. So it's like, you need those Wolfgang Pucks. You need those creative minds who are doing those things. So you need a balance of both. I think that's kind of what I'm trying to say is, it's like, you know, what he's trying to say is, I'd rather have someone I can rely on every day.
Yeah.
Who's not going to fuck up and who's I can just lean on as a line cook versus some asshole who's going to try to take my job.
Yeah.
So,
the artist versus the hard worker.
Yeah. Well, he goes further on that. I think it's on page 69 where I get to, and this is one thing I was really interested in. He's like, I can break down line cooks into three subgroups. The artists, which he calls the annoying high maintenance minority. This group includes specialists like patisseries, sous chefs, butchers, garde-manger, psychos, the occasional saucier whose saucers are so ethereal and perfect that delusions of grandeur are tolerated. And then he goes on to say that there are the exiles, people who just can't make it in any other business, could never survive a 9-to-5 job, wear a tie, or blend in with civilized society. And then he talks about the mercenaries, which I brought up earlier, which are the people that just do it because they're really good at it. Mm-hmm. And they have pride in what they do, and they're probably going to do it for the rest of their lives. And he says, at the end of the day, he would take a mercenary over anyone.
Yeah.
And I think you and I probably are at that point now in our careers working in the industry, as it were, probably both mercenaries, both love what we do. We're very passionate about what we do. We're really good at what we do, but you know, it's, we're not looking to be.
Not looking to win any cocktail competition. Is what you're saying?
Oh, by the way, shout out to Chris Enns. Chris Enns, who was on episode, what was he on? Episode four?
This is our second guest, episode four. Yeah.
Episode four. So yeah. Chris Enns, bartender at the Fairmont Pacific Rim, Diageo World Class Global Final, which was in Berlin this past week. He came eighth in the world out of probably 60 some bartenders. So congratulations to him.
Unbelievable.
And the guys over there at that team there. That's awesome. Go Canada. I think Australia won this year.
Yeah. I remember seeing that. Yeah. Well, we have to have Chris on again.
Yeah, we should bring him back on. Yeah. Definitely get his experience. So I don't know.
I never thought that you would have been quoting The Devil Wears Prada on our podcast, but it happened. I like the whole professionalism, but like in the contrast of, you know, the 9-to-5 worker, because people associate the restaurant or, you know, serving or working in a kitchen as like a non-professional profession, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But like,
it's like a sub-profession.
Sub-profession. But really, it's like, you know, he outlines this in his book. If you don't work with people who are serious about their job in the industry, it's like super detrimental and makes your job way, way harder. And you can say that in any field, but especially in the restaurant industry, and especially working on a line, if you don't have people who are like serious about their job or take their shit seriously, it can like just completely mess everything up.
Or like, dude, I'm just doing this job for like next 6 months until I get my BA and I'm an actor.
Yeah, or
like,
I do graphic design or whatever. Yeah.
Or my dad's just going to get me on with this firm and I'm only doing this to make some money.
People like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same as any other industry, and actually even way harder to execute, because you're working with like fire and things that are really hot and like people's expectations and like a lot of pressure, right?
So here's a better question. And I mean, we've probably touched on this numerous times in the past of our podcast. Why do you think people undervalue or look at the restaurant community as a secondary job? Like, why is it like I've had this recently. So is this all you do? Do you do anything else? Like that question,
Try going on Bumble and Tinder. As soon as the question comes up of what you do for a living and the bartender is sent across via text, it's like ghost city. Like there's nobody messages you back.
Yeah,
like,
you probably make way more money than
she does. Oh, sorry, you're not like an insurance salesman, or you're not in advertising, or you're not, you know, in medical school or whatever. It's like, man, it's crazy. Yeah, it's like, well, a stigma that's attached to the industry for
forever. Where does that come from?
I don't know, man. It's not like there's not schooling that goes into it.
Do you think it's because it's a service?
If you want to be a chef and you want to work in an actual...
Well, here's a prime example. Like if you're a hairstylist, you're performing a service.
You go to school.
You're going to school. If you're a massage therapist, you go to school. I'm just going on like trades, mostly like this. If you're a plumber, you go to school.
Yeah.
If you work in a kitchen and you make delicious food that everyone fucking loves and they rave about, why are you considered... like a low end.
You go to school for it.
Yeah. But why are you like, why is it something that people consider like a second valued career?
I don't know.
It's weird.
We've talked about this a lot. People need like social escape from their regular lives. They need to interact with other people. They need to eat. They need to drink and relax. They need to have conversation, humor, all those sort of things that people provide.
I'm not
going to
lie. I even do it myself. Like sometimes, like I remember when I first met my girlfriend's parents, and you know, they go like, where, like, what does he do for a living? I sometimes catch myself even saying I'm a sommelier, because that sounds like people are like, oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Versus just saying like bartender.
Or like I run the bar program.
Yeah. Or
like,
yeah. Or I'm a bar manager.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like I'm a podcaster now, which is true. But your primary source of income is bartending.
But I mean, why am I hesitant to say that? Why am I embarrassed?
I don't know. It's like a hang up. Yeah. Like I've had this my whole life as well. Like, oh, you work in the service industry. And that's kind of one of the main reasons why I got into management, to sort of like legitimize my life choices.
Yeah.
You get into managing, you get into AGMing, then you get to GMing, and then you realize there's no fucking money.
Oh yeah, there's no money.
All the money's in bartending and serving.
Yeah.
Right? And also the freedom of hours. And flexibility with your schedule, right? If you work in a 9-to-5 job, you're set 9-to-5. That's fine. You build your life around those hours and you have your weekends and all that kind of stuff. But I think what sort of delegitimizes the industry is the fact that you're not in those like those contrived tripes of like professionalism and like work structure that I think a lot of people can't relate to.
But I mean, like, try going up.
Actually, think about it. It actually makes more sense to the environment that we live in and like the world we live in. for freedom of like, you know, if I want to do something the day, I have that option. If I want to, you know, have my freelance graphic design business on the side, I can do that. I can like not work for a month and be totally fine. Like also not to mention, I'm not sure if I should be saying on this podcast, but like tax-free money, right? Which a lot of people don't realize.
Shut up.
Cash tips are a big thing, man. And that's kind of how we make our money in the industry. But, you know, I'm surprised none of that. Actually, he does touch on that in the book.
He touches on a little bit. Yeah, he does a little bit.
But
he does.
Hopefully no one from CRA is listening, hopefully.
Well, he even says this in the book, or in his afterwards, he says he wished he spent more time on the front house.
Yeah.
He says he didn't spend enough time talking about servers and bartenders. He only spends like literally a page on bartenders. Yeah. He spends like a page on servers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've touched on the animosity or the perceived animosity between back house and front house, but really we're all on the same team. They're selling the food that the chef made, right? Yeah. And they're tipping out the kitchen as well. So there's a big camaraderie aspect of it. You know, going back to the industry and how it doesn't really seem to have, it's kind of changing, but we still don't have that, you know, obviously we're never going to be in this regarded as the same industry as like, you know, someone who's in the medical field or someone who's, you know,
even though you're providing
insurance salesman, I'm not saying whatever,
but you're providing a service that everyone needs.
I agree 100%.
Which I think is very, very like, it'd be different if we were working in an industry that we knew that in 15 years is probably going to disappear.
Yeah.
This is an industry that's never going to go away. And people, and even in times of peril, when the economy generally drops, is generally where it actually picks up a lot of pace because it's the only thing that people can afford to do still.
Yeah.
So which I find very interesting. And try explaining or try talking to anyone who works in the industry after they've worked, gotten their ass kicked for 12 hours, that they didn't work their ass off and that their job isn't worthy of their time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Like it's a very difficult job. It's a very demanding job and it's very hard work. Yes, the only thing that I would say is I think maybe the reason why it's very undervalued is because a lot of people think it's lax. You don't need a lot of education to do it.
Yeah.
So that's probably the number one thing. But even then, it's getting to a point now where like if you want to get a job at like one of the top end restaurants, if you don't have qualifications as a really good bartender, or if you don't have wine training, or if you don't have like experience even working on the floor,
right,
or Red Seal or whatever those things, you're not getting hired.
Yeah.
So there is stepping stones you need to achieve to get
absolutely
the better quality jobs.
And I guess you could say this in any industry, but you know, there's, you know, if you're working at a shitty dive bar.
Yeah, you can just walk in off the street and probably get a job.
That's different than working at the industry standard institutions that are all throughout North America and throughout the world, right? That's kind of what we're talking about. But like we said, the stigma has slowly been changing and it's changing even more exponentially now.
Yeah. Well, I always think this is very funny. It was like when people talk about like how they undervalue our industry, they disrespect our industry. They say, what are you doing outside of this? Because they want you to like, they think that what you're doing right now is, it should be a stepping stone to something else. Yet that every single thing that people do when they travel is go out and eat at nice restaurants and go for food because it is what every fucking person wants to do in this world.
Yeah.
Yet if you undervalue what I do for a living, then why is it so important to you to go to other cities and check out the great restaurants and check out the great bars?
Yeah.
If it's so
important. It's what you do when your office closes.
Exactly. So if what I do for a living is something that I should be ashamed of, then why are you so proud to go to it all the time?
Yeah. You know? Good point. Really, I feel good about my life choices now. Really. Thank you. I want to touch on a couple of things in the book. So I worked at a place called Sammy J. Pepper's for part of 10 years.
That was a little preachy there.
It was a little preachy, but we always get preachy on the show. It's like we have this thing where like, oh, we don't want to get too preachy. And then we just like spout off our opinions about everything. So I used to work at this place called Sammy J. Pepper's and I was a manager there, but I started as a busser and a junior server. And then I worked up to server and then I worked up to bartender. And this place was, they're still around, I think. They have a couple locations, one in Delta, Coquitlam and Langley. And they're sort of like a total Western food, like steaks, seafood, pasta, all that kind of stuff. And I got in there because my good friend at the time, his girlfriend, Alana, got me in there. I had just come off of, I think it was busing at the Old Spaghetti Factory in Gastown or something like that.
You worked there?
Yeah, I worked at the Old Spaghetti Factory in Gastown, man. Yeah.
And you make fun Spimento of my devil. You make fun of my devil's work product.
Hey man, you worked at McDonald's, so shut the hell up. So, anyways, I went to work at this place called Sammy J. Pepper's, and as I worked up through, it was just a fun place to work. There was like, you know, lots of hot women, fun atmosphere, cash tips. And then when I got into management, the management's job during the lunch rush and the evening rush was to work the grill.
What?
Was to work the grill. So you had to step in when you were front house manager. So you'd clip your tie in, roll up your sleeves and you get on the grill. And the reason being is because we were trained. To do everything.
Yeah, which is the way you should be trained.
You're like a fix-all. You know, Ron said it best. Like, he does everything. Yeah. If someone calls him sick, he fills in that spot. So when I was reading the passages about the mise en place and the line and getting everything ready, I got like a really sweeping feel of nostalgia because I know what it's like to have seven orders on the grill with steaks, all different temps. I know what it's like to be calling out all these lines. Like, I have a direct...
I mean, it's very similar on the bar too. I mean, you get a lot of this.
Similar on the bar as well.
You have to set everything up, get everything ready to go.
Rags, have everything where you want it to be. Yeah. So there's a lot of similarities.
And if you're not prepared properly, you can get royally fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I remember working at Joe Winston and, like, you know, 12 shits up, full patio, and all of a sudden you blow a keg and you got no one to help you and you go, okay, I have to make a decision here.
Yeah.
Either I go change that keg and I come back and I come back to chaos, or I tell everyone that they don't have that beer for the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it's like you run, go change that keg, and you come back and you're like, oh great, now I have 22 chits up.
Yeah.
So
you know, those aspects of the book I really connected with. And I really, you know, it's unless you've been there and you've done it, and I think a lot of people listening to this podcast are know exactly what we're talking about, there is a certain terror and then there's a certain sweeping satisfaction when you get through a service.
Like, have you I guarantee you've had this, but have you ever had an experience where you're like at a point where you looked around and you're like, I actually don't know what I should do next because I'm so fucking busy. And I'm like, you're like, literally the back of your shirt is literally soaked with sweat. You're beating with, and you have so many people, like you have a person waiting to get pay a bill and you have to make all these, you have to do all these drinks and you have someone, you have to take a food order and you have to run. And you're so like in the shit that you're like, how the fuck am I going to get out of this?
You just got to stop and like, yeah, like 10
take
and
2
then
seconds.
Like get back into
and
it.
You have no help.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That to me is like, I've had a few of those moments where you're like, I was like literally almost hyperventilating. I was just like, this is so busy.
Yeah. But try to tell me that's not stressful. God damn it.
Funny, on page 76, he says one sentence, which I will take to my grave when it comes to as a diner. If I'd never worked in a restaurant, I would still feel this way. He writes, I won't eat in a restaurant with filthy bathrooms. Uh-huh. That is, for me, the number one key to a restaurant. If I go to a restaurant, even now, if I go into your bathroom and it's disgusting, to me, that tells me everything about your restaurant. It tells me that you don't care, that if your bathroom is disgusting, because that's where everyone's going to go, that I don't even know what your kitchen looks like. And I've been into some restaurants that are gorgeous, and then you walk in the bathroom and it smells like piss. It's gross, and it looks like they haven't cleaned the sinks in a while, and the floors around the edges are disgusting. To me, like—
Which ones were those?
Yeah, probably name a lot of restaurants. So, but
no, don't do that.
When he wrote that, I was just like, oh, okay, I get that. I totally see that.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment for sure.
Page 78. Well, I sent this to you last night.
Yes.
And you're like, I don't want to talk too much about this because you're like, it's such a small part of the book. But he talks about vegetarians.
It's literally a paragraph. But I think Anthony Bourdain hasn't been shy about his views on vegetarians and vegans.
He writes, vegetarians and their Hezbollah-like splinter faction, the vegans, are a persistent irritant to any chef worth a damn. To me, life without veal stock, pork fat, sausage, organ meat, demi-glaze, or even stinky cheese is a life not worth living. Vegetarians are the enemy of everything good and decent in the human spirit, an affront to all I stand for, the pure enjoyment of food. I will tell you 100%, if he wrote that now in 2018, he would get a lot of shit for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that shows how much the book is dated.
Yeah.
It's like, that is, I mean, so many people nowadays see themselves as vegetarians or vegans. It's definitely a growing movement.
Absolutely.
We've talked about this. We had a whole episode dedicated to this. I'm at a point now where I don't even eat that much meat anymore, or a lot of dairy products or of that
Good
sort.
Good for you, Jimmy.
But I mean, I only want to bring that up because I just want to see how you reacted to that. I mean, sure, you probably have read that many a time and seen that, but so probably doesn't even bother you anymore, but.
Doesn't bother me in the least. No. I mean, he's a chef, right? He's supposed to eat meat. He's supposed to know everything about meat. Yeah, in this day and age, and especially where we live in Vancouver, you know, things are changing. Yeah. And if you don't have vegetarian or vegan stuff on your menu, then you're not going to succeed, unfortunately. But yeah, I got really nothing to say about that, actually. It makes me laugh, actually.
Damn it. I was hoping to get more out of you. I was hoping you'd be all pissed off or angry.
Nah. I'm used to it, man.
So page 83, he talks about... If I know you're storing your squid at room temperature next to a cat box, I'll get my squid down the street. Thank you very much. I will continue to do my seafood eating on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays because I know better, because I can wait. But if I have one chance at a full-blown dinner, a blowfish gizzard, even if I have not been properly introduced to the chef, and I'm in a strange Far Eastern city and my plane leaves tomorrow, I'm going for it. You can only live around once. The reason why I want to bring this up is I think that right there is the paragraph that leads to his TV show.
Oh, okay.
That's the reason why it was interesting to me. It doesn't really talk too much about like what he's interested in. I think really what he's talking about. And he talks about this early on in the book, where like how he got a lot of his inspiration for being adventurous with food is because he just wanted to be kind of a rebel against his family.
Yeah.
But this is to me, like when you read that paragraph, it just talks about his, like, I can just see that with Parts Unknown and all that stuff. It's just like, and I think that's kind of a big thing with his TV show from what I've glommed onto is that like he'll go to Thailand, he'll go to Vietnam and he'll eat whatever. Yeah. He's not afraid to go into those little shacks and try the weirdest thing. And I think people really respect that. And they're also kind of maybe interested and intrigued by what he's going to say about it. I think that right there is probably one of his, probably going to be his lasting legacy, is in the sense that he's, you know, opened up new ideas of way food is in other cultures, but not the hoity-toity stuff that you would see at like mission-starred restaurants and stuff like this. He kind of glomps onto the common man. So that was the only thing that I wanted to pick up from that. I don't know.
It speaks to his authenticity.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
For sure. And foray into the world of celebrity chefism and TV hosting.
Yeah, exactly. On page 97, he talks about something that I've actually seen before, and I actually kind of feel very much the same. He talks about this idea, the cumulative vibe of a history of failed restaurants can infect an address year after year, even in an otherwise bustling neighborhood. You can see it when passerby peer into the front window of the next operator. There's a scowl, a look of suspicion, as if they are afraid of contamination. And he's talking about the idea of graveyard restaurants.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big thing in the industry, is that, like, you know, I mean, obviously it makes sense to take over an old restaurant that's failed. And because they've already got the plumbing, the kitchen, and all the bones of putting a new restaurant in there. It happens all the time. But it is something that I've seen more over, is that like you can kind of get the stink of an old restaurant. And I really kind of resonated with that because I've seen a lot of restaurants go through that. I mean, there was that space here in Vancouver where Ensemble used to be, right on the corner of Thurlow and Rorard. There must have been like 10 or 15 restaurants go into that little space. And I think right now there's like, I think they put a Japanese restaurant in there now. But for a long time, it was just like a rotating door of restaurant after restaurant after restaurant. And it's like, eventually you just kind of get the stink of that restaurant. And I just, when I read that, I was like, okay, this is, to me, is like where this book is really cool, because you get a lot of insight into those things. So you, as a person who doesn't work in the industry, or if you do work in the industry, you might not understand or you might not realize.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we've seen that before. I mean, it happens all the time. Restaurants die and you get a new one just pop up.
Yeah.
Because I mean, even where I live now in Chinatown, there is a place just right around the corner on Union Street, which just shut down. And there's a new restaurant that just went in there. And I know
Was it the Union?
No, it's not the Union.
Oh, okay.
It was this place called Roost, which was fucking terrible. I hated it. Every time I went in there, I always got the worst service. It was so small and they were always closed and it was irritating. And then the people from Birds and the Beats went in there and took it over. And it's this new place called Honeybee. And I'm stoked for them. They supposedly they do a really good job at Birds and the Beats, and I love what they do there. So I was like, sweet, another great new spot in my area.
Yeah, there's
lots in my area. But I will say that every time I walk by, I still feel that stink of the other place.
Hmm.
Even because they didn't change too much to look, I still, every time I walk in, I'm like, like it's still kind of got that something.
Yeah. Do you think that will change or?
Yeah, it'll change. Like even funnily enough, I actually went there 2 weeks ago to go for brunch, and I walked in and the one item that I wanted to get, they were out of.
Oh.
So I was like, oh, so this reminds me of the last time I was here with the other owners.
You didn't get what you wanted.
Shut up.
Damn.
No, but it was just like, I haven't had a good experience in that location yet.
Maybe that will change. Maybe
yes,
it won't.
I'm confident these guys will knock it
out. Maybe it won't. Yeah. Maybe it has a stigma.
Yes. But have you ever experienced that before?
I can't say that I have, no.
No?
But I did go to my previously mentioned old spot, Sammy J. Pepper's, at Burnaby, across the street from Metrotown, and it's now a dim sum place. But I went up there and I just looked around because the structure's all the same. They didn't do any of the inside renovating. Had a nice little trip down memory lane. It was nice.
Why would they call it Sammy J. Pepper's?
I don't know.
Dumb name.
What's up, Mike Gardner, if you're listening?
Okay.
He's the owner. Yeah.
You want me to ask him?
I ran into him at the airport, actually, where I work at the bar. randomly like 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It was fun.
Is he older?
I don't know. I don't know how old he is. 45?
Like 40s?
Okay. Yeah.
I just want to know what that means. Sammy J. Peppers.
I don't know. I think he was a co-owner with this guy named Marv. And I think Sammy was his daughter's name.
Oh, okay.
And the J was maybe his son's initial Peppers because they had, like, their thing was they had hot sauces. So they had this huge wall of hot sauce.
Oh, so there was like a theme.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they did really like suicide hot wings.
You said their concept was basically like a local.
No, it was like Western food.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was it good food?
No, not really. I don't know.
Why don't you work there?
Nah, I wouldn't say the food was... I would say it was above like...
Like Moxie's?
I would say it was like on par with like Cactus Club, Moxie's, that kind of...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, same stuff.
Okay.
Everyone's ordering from GFS, same shit.
So just the same boring food that you can get everywhere else?
Yeah. And a thing called the New Orleans Combo Skillet, which was, I think, 4 different types of meat on mashed potatoes smothered in hot sauce and garlic sauce. Yeah, super popular. It came out like a hot skillet.
Did you ever have it?
What you had to do to sell it, because I used to work pans too, is you had to put the skillet on the burner so it would get hot enough and then transfer that over with tongs to a little wooden holding surface. And man, those tongs, if you didn't have the right grip, it would slip
and
the
slip
edge
off.
Of the skillet would burn you to shit. Yeah. So yeah.
Did that happen to you?
Stressful times. Not to me, but I've seen a lot of skillet burns, man. I seen a guy get a skillet in the neck.
What?
Yeah, dude.
Actually, you know, that is actually something we can talk about that right now. He even talks about like how like chefs are like proud of their scars and burns. That is a very common thing. I've talked to a lot of chefs about that. They're very proud of that stuff.
Absolutely.
And I've seen some chefs with some fucking gnarly scars.
Yep.
All over their arms and forearms. Actually, that's one of the things I actually would be very hesitant to want to work in a kitchen.
Yeah.
Like all fucked up hands and...
Crazy lot, those chefs, those mercenaries.
Yeah, those mercenaries. On page 254, he talks about this homophobic, and he talks about like, well, I shouldn't say homophobic. That's a really bad way for me to start this. But he talks about like being sensitive in the industry. Homophobic, you say, submental, insensitive to gender preference and the gorgeous mosaic of the ethically diverse workforce. Gee, you might be right. Does a locker room environment like this make it tougher for women, for instance? Yep. Most women, sadly, but what the system seeks, what it requires is someone, anyone who can hold up his station, play the game without getting bent out of shape and taking things personally. If you are easily offended by direct aspersions on your lineage, the circumstances of your birth, your sexuality, your appearance, the mention of your parents possibly commingling with livestock, then the world of professional cooking is not for you. So that right there is probably...
Like, but I think it also speaks to the time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right? Like, this is one of the things. So, I mean, when you read this book, you read that and you're like, okay, this is where you can kind of go.
Yeah,
okay.
Like if you go to Juniper, go to Barack & Co. or any new sort of stylized kitchen, it's very calm.
Yeah.
It's very organized. It's very...
But I mean, even the way he talks about like with... The,
equal. Yeah. Everyone, you know, is equal depending on your sexual orientation or your gender or whatever. Yeah. That whole sort of like this rough and tumble, boorish idea of a chef.
And where if you're a woman, you can't handle that. Like guys talking about things like that.
Only like the you know, the bitchiest, most hardest women can handle it in the kitchen. It's totally different now. And again, that's a part of the book that I think hasn't aged very well. Yeah. Is that mentality of that sort of like bro culture chef thing, you know?
Well, did you see that ironically, Gordon Ramsay, who's kind of known for this type of personality of running his chefs, his old head chef who used to run his top restaurant, Gordon Ramsay, which is the one that he has his 3 Michelin stars in London. She ran it for a long, long time. And then she spawned off and did her own restaurant. Her name is Claire Smith. I think that's what it is. I read last week that she was now awarded, I think, 2 Michelin stars.
Nice.
At her restaurant for her first time doing it on her own.
Good for
and
him.
I think that's like one of the highest regards for a woman running a kitchen in the UK.
Awesome.
And I think he's going to help her to get to her 3rd star. But I think that's amazing. Like when you read stuff like that, and like Gordon talks about how she's probably one of the best chefs he's in the world, and he's so proud of that. And I think that shows like
how times are changing. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was really cool.
Thank God for the better.
Well, and then you see stuff like Taylor Swift. Did you read about this the other day?
No. I thought you were going to say Kavanaugh getting elected as Supreme Court Justice.
No, Taylor Swift.
We're kind of getting into current events here on Track and Food Podcast. I know.
Well, it's just because it filters into a lot of stuff we're talking about here. She went on Instagram the other day and she kind of picked a side, and she says she wants people to vote Democrat. And she wrote all the reasons saying like, you know, they I want people who are for women's rights and LGBT and gay. And it kind of touches on a lot of stuff, like how our world is changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like how some people are viewing those things that way.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few other things we could touch on. I mean, the bartender thing we also talked about. The one thing I found interesting is on page 307, he even concedes this later on in the after where he talks about like how some of the up-and-coming chefs of the time, I think this is in 2000, obviously, talks about some of the ones like Tom Colicchio at Gramercy Tavern. And then he also talks about Rocco DeSpirito.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny because you remember that show that Rocco DeSpirito came out with in like, I think it was like 2003 or something like that, or 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and then he started his own restaurant. And I guess he was like a really big deal, but like I read about him and he just like, I don't think he's in the game anymore.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because I think it was him or Kevin Alexander did a really big piece on him 2 years ago, where they're saying, I wonder where Rocco DeSpirito is, and they want to know if he's still in the industry. So I thought that was kind of cool. Yeah. Interesting, like when he like touches on people like that.
But, yeah, I mean, obviously he's had, Anthony's written with his fiction and with his graphic novel, probably around 13 books. And I think in the later ones, it's more of a view into the sort of celebrity chef life. And he, you know, interviews all this, you know, his contemporaries in the field. But in this one, obviously he was sort of just still, getting to that point where he was getting into his more celebrity.
Well, I'm kind of curious to see what he talks about in Medium Raw, which is the one I think he came up with like 10 years later.
Maybe we'll read it next.
Yes. No. Yeah. By the way, so this was my choice. And
well, I just want to say, I'm glad you picked this book. It was really interesting diving into the world of Anthony Bourdain. We haven't touched yet on anything that's happened. And we've mentioned it on a previous podcast. We don't think we're qualified to even get into any of the mental health stuff, but that's why for people listening, we want to just take this book as a separate piece and talk about the book as it is. And it's tough, you know, with everything that's happened with him to not read something like this and read into all the aspects of it. Cause there's lines in this book we can be like,
well, it's,
okay, that's a window into his,
when you talk about
his
that,
psyche
like,
and his troubled self at the time.
I almost wrote a piece about that a little while ago. I was reading the book and I came from it and I, because of his death and all the stuff, I kind of had all these thoughts. So I started writing something. Then I got one of my friends to read it and he was just like, this is a little bit too sensitive. I wasn't trying to be insensitive. I was just more, reading the book, it made me think, because there's things you kind of piece out, you know, like you're trying to look for clues.
And, you know, not just the, you know, women's rights, Me Too, gay rights, all these things, you know, mental health is one of those things in our times, in our zeitgeist that we live in, that's changing, thank God, for the better. But I want to say that just reading this book was really fun. I'm glad you picked it. It was a really interesting romp into that world, and it was super, super fun. Now, that being said,
it's your turn to pick a
book. Rules are, I now get to pick a book.
Yes.
So, because I am a vegan.
I don't know this, by the way. I don't know what he's talked about. So, I have no idea, by the way. Just full disclosure, he has not told me what he's going
to
do.
Yeah, so the book I wanted to feature for the next, what are we calling it? Track and Food Book Club?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's the word. If anybody has a
Jamie
better title,
read a book.
Email us. But I think that's good.
This is actually based on our Veganism versus Carnism.
Okay.
And the Ezra Klein Vox podcast.
Okay.
But it's not the book by whatever her name was.
Dr. Melanie Joy.
This is actually another book associated with that. And what's interesting about this book is that it came out in 2009, but there was actually a documentary that just came out. So what we are going to do is not only read a book, but watch a documentary.
Huh.
Fun stuff. So the book is called, by Christopher Dillon. It was a 2009 book called Eating Animals. And the documentary just came out last year. It's narrated by Natalie Portman.
Okay.
Say no more.
Yes.
Basically about the food industrial complex and how a lot of farmers are making the push to go back to grass-fed, free-range, small-impact farming, which is how things started before the monstrosity of Monsanto and, you know, everything else that's happened, well documented. So what we're going to do is read that book and watch the documentary and then kind of compare sort of, has it aged well? Are the ideas similar? It's only been 11 years.
Did the documentary just come out?
Just came out last year.
Okay.
Yep.
What a perfect person to have narrated, by the way. I'm excited. Okay. I'm excited. I'll happily read this. I've heard of this book.
You have?
I have heard of
awesome.
it.
Awesome.
I've never, obviously, haven't.
I'm turning into a vegan yet, man.
Yeah, look at you. You're just kind of like, you're just trying to feed it into me, huh? Yeah. Trying to get me all these stories and all these visions and all these ideas in my head. And I'm just going to, next time I'm going to look at a steak and I'm just be grossed out.
Yeah. Well, you should be.
And then I'm going to text you a big, fuck you.
If that is listening, who's a meat eater, don't listen to me. This is my own personal
thing. I know, I'm kidding.
You go ahead, keep eating meat.
But if you ever turn pork chops on me, I'm going to kill you.
No. Well, I mean, why would I would never do that.
I know, I'm just kidding. No. But I mean, at the end of the day, we've talked about this many times before, but the morality of those choices when it comes to food, I mean, like you said, if all farming was done in the ethical way and smaller farms and more humane and the animals were treated very fairly, I don't know. I mean, like, I wonder if at the end of the day would change people's views on how they eat meat. So, you know, knowing that, like, you know, if you see these massive factory farms and the animals are being slaughtered and they're being treated inhumanely, you know, a lot of people are being turned off by that. But if it was brought back to the way it probably was done 100 years ago, you know, I wonder if that would change. Obviously, it would change people's views, but well, I'm excited to read the book.
Well, people would argue that you can't really kill a sentient life form that has feels pain and has thoughts, whether they be brief. You can't get around that.
Yeah,
aspect
I get that one too.
That's kind of the main sort of mantra for vegans, but
yeah.
But
we are going to be hosting, we brought this up last time, but we've actually got everything confirmed. On October 20th, we're going to be doing a live podcast at the Chefs in the Hood, which our guests, TJ Conway and Bruce Noller, which we had on our previous podcast. They're doing their events down at the courthouse here in Vancouver. Looks like it's going to be sold out, I think. There's going to be 400 people there. It's going to be a ton of great chefs from some great neighborhoods in the city. It's going to have some great charity causes with it. We are very excited to be a part of this. We're very excited to be there. We're going to talk about some of the people that are involved, their experience doing the events before and after. Look for that podcast. We're hoping to have that up very soon after that. So probably around the 21st, 22nd, 23rd. In the meantime, we have some great guests lined up as well. This podcast should be up in the next little bit, so we are excited to have this one out. Thank you for listening. Anything you also want to add to me?
Stop putting pressure on me, man.
I know.
But come on, when they come out. Don't give me deadlines on the air.
I'm putting one on that one. You just can't release it 2 weeks later. I also wrote an article on Medium this past week, so do check that out, medium.com/trackandfood. It's on our Instagram page. You can find us. Podcast links are on there. Obviously, find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher. Thank you for listening. And this was a lot of fun. And Mick, we'll talk to you soon.
See ya.